This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel launches airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, the first such attack since the end of the 11-day Israeli onslaught on the enclave last month. More than 30 Palestinians are injured by Israeli forces during a protest against a settlers' march in occupied Jerusalem outskirts. And officials in the Canadian state of Ontario launch a search for unmarked graves of Indigenous residential school students. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in at World News. Israeli warplanes have attacked a Palestinian training camp in the south of the Gaza Strip, as well as areas in Khan Yunis. Radio station belonging to the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas reported the attack. Explosions were also heard in Gaza City. Latest aggression is the first Israeli strike on the enclave since the ceasefire ended 11 days of conflict last month. Israeli forces have not yet commented on this attack. And joining us now out of Gaza City is Ashraf Shannon for more on the story. Hello, Ashraf. Hope you're safe and doing well. What can you add to the story, Ashraf?
Well, Danny, Israeli drones initially attacked two security posts that belong to Hamas's military wing, the Izmir Qassam Brigades, one in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis, and another one in the south of Gaza City. Minutes later, they used Israeli F-16 fighter jets to bomb those training centers that belong to Hamas's military wing. The Israeli military did issue a statement minutes ago saying that the attacks were a retaliation for incendiary balloons that were flown from the Gaza Strip earlier. Although Hamas is not responsible for the incendiary balloons, they were flown by Palestinian youth as a form of protest against the march by extremist Jewish settlers in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Hamas movement spokesperson Hazem Qasem said that the Israeli airstrikes were just another example of Israel's violation of Palestinian rights. And he also said that the Palestinian resistance factions will defend Jerusalem Al-Quds no matter what happens.
And Ashraf, that protest earlier by settlers, or the demonstration or celebration, whatever you want to call it, March of the Flags, I heard they're walking through the streets yelling obscenities, saying kill the Arabs and stuff like that.
Yes, so this is this is what they've been doing for years now. And let's not forget that last month, such a provocation by Israeli extremist settlers led to Palestinian resistance group Hamas firing rockets towards Jerusalem Al-Quds and initiating the battle of the sword of Jerusalem Al-Quds against the Israeli regime, because the Palestinian resistance groups did not sit idle while Israeli regime was threatening the Palestinians in East Jerusalem Al-Quds and also desecrating the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and also trying to evict Palestinians in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Jerusalem.
Thank you, Ashraf. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon from Gaza City. Ashraf Shannon, they're updating us. Now, Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians protesting against a march by Israeli settlers in occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds, our correspondent just told you about. A Palestinian Red Crescent said 33 people were injured during the clashes. Regime forces also arrested several Palestinians who were demonstrating against the so-called March of the Flags. Moreover, Israeli forces blocked Palestinians' access to the Damascus Gate leading to the Old City and pushing them away. Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements in the Gaza Strip have warned that they will not respond firmly to any provocative acts by the settlers. Separately, the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shataya, sounded the alarm about dangerous repercussions of the Israeli event. Palestinians in Gaza have held similar demonstrations to slam the settlers' parade.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held demonstrations in several parts of the enclave in response to the return of the controversial flag march in East Jerusalem al-Quds. The protesters said the move is aimed at provoking Palestinians' anger. They burnt Israeli flags and vowed to defend Jerusalem al-Quds with all means.
The Israeli regime is responsible for the consequences of its crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. It's provoking us by holding this flag march. Palestinian resistance in all parts of Palestine announces its readiness to respond to the violations in Al-Aqsa Mosque. The international community should stop such violations.
The extremist flag march passed through the old city's Damascus Gate and entered the Muslim Quarter. This amid a fragile ceasefire in the Gaza Strip following the recent Israeli aggression that claimed nearly 250 Palestinian lives. The flag march caused Hamas to warn that the tensions in the Gaza Strip will break out again after Israel's 11-day escalation on the enclave.
Our Palestinian people are all united in defending Jerusalem al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our message is clear that we will not allow Israel to impose its plans of stealing our land and holy places. We will sacrifice everything for Palestine, and the resistance is ready to fight back. We do not trust any Israeli ceasefire, and we are committed to it as long as Israel keeps it.
Palestinian resistance in Gaza announced its readiness for any conflict against the Israeli regime in response to the violations against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds.
Any Palestinian would feel angry for what is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Israeli violations of our rights. We are all united in facing this occupation. We are supporting the resistance and we are proud of its achievements in defending us. We will not give up Al-Quds and our holy places, and the Israeli plans there will fail because we are the true owners of the land.
The controversial flag march in Jerusalem Al-Quds risks reigniting tensions with Palestinians, both in the occupied territories and the Gaza Strip. Hamas has warned that the march will trigger a new conflict for defending Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Palestinian human rights lawyer Jonathan Kutab says the settlers' parade is so provocative that some Israelis advise against holding it this year.
Well, this is actually a recurring event that occurs several times, usually once a year. It celebrates the conquest of Jerusalem, and it's a very right-wing, racist celebration, insisting that Jerusalem is just for Jews. And it's usually done in a very provocative way, going through the old city, through the Muslim quarters, through the areas where Palestinians usually live, basically to tell them, we won, we are the masters of this place, and you are worth nothing. In fact, it is so provocative that the Israeli police recommended that it be canceled this year, or that it take place in a different location and not in the Arab sectors and the Muslim sectors of the city. But unfortunately, they decided to do it there anyway.
Saudi Arabia has come under fire by international rights groups for executing a man for crimes he allegedly committed as a minor. Amnesty International said that Mustafa Hashim al-Darwish was a victim of Riyadh's deeply flawed justice system. Anti-death penalty group Reprieve branded the Saudi act as a human rights crisis, said that Mustafa's family was not notified prior to his killing. Both groups, as well as Mustafa himself, said the confession used for his sentencing was obtained under duress. Man was arrested in 2015. He was charged with protest-related crimes that he allegedly committed when he was 17. His execution was carried out despite a pledge by Saudi authorities last year to end capital punishment based on childhood offenses. The U.S. Agency for International Development says the Yemeni province of Ma'arib needs more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address its growing crisis. Yemenis, though, believe the agency is using humanitarian assistance as a cover-up for its military activities, such as providing arms for terrorist groups in Ma'arib. Our correspondent in Sana'a has your story.
The U.S. State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs said the U.S. envoy to Yemen has met with the director of USAID to discuss the need for more donors to provide additional humanitarian funding to address the growing crisis in Ma'arib. Experts believe that this step is an attempt by the U.S. to provide new weapons to its tools in Ma'arib, including terrorist groups who protect its agenda in the oil-rich province.
The continued advancement of the Yemeni army toward liberating Ma'arib prompted the United States to use the humanitarian crisis to supply the terrorist groups in Ma'arib with weapons so that the conflict could not be prolonged. U.S. push for peace has no basis in reality, and continued siege on the Yemeni people is a proof.
Observers said the USAID plays a suspicious role wherever it exists, adding that it uses the humanitarian and relief work as a cover-up for its military and intelligence activities.
The U.S. Agency for International Development is an intelligence agency. It shows the humanitarian aspect, but it hides a lot of illegal activities, including supporting terrorist groups with weapons. The United States will not accept peace unless its conditions are met. Washington is the one who leads the war in Yemen and cannot be a peacemaker.
Last year, the Yemeni army found large quantities of weapons carrying the logo of USAID in Al Bayda and Ma'arib front lines after recapturing areas that were controlled by Daesh and Al-Qaeda. Yemenis believe that the U.S. is directly involved in the deadly war against their country. They say it is their right to liberate their lands from any foreign existence, as well as terrorist groups who serve the interests of the U.S. and Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Peace negotiations between the Taliban and Afghan government have resumed in Qatar for a first time since talks stalled back in April. Kabul said the meeting was held between the contact groups of the two negotiation teams, and a comprehensive discussion was held on the organization and arrangements of the talks. Taliban spokesman also tweeted a similar statement. Peace talks between the government and the Taliban hit an impasse when their group refused to participate in a summit in Turkey on Afghanistan's future. Resumption now comes as the U.S. is pulling out the last of its troops from Afghanistan by September the 11th. And an Afghan delegation comprising politicians, MPs, and retired diplomats are in Islamabad under what's known as a Track 2 diplomacy. This after negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban failed to show any signs of progress amid allegations that Islamabad is supporting the militant group. Javed Rana reports.
The U.S. troops are fast withdrawing from Afghanistan under a peace deal American had with the Taliban 2 years ago. On the other hand, the Taliban, the militant group who already control nearly 75% territory, is now sieging and capturing districts and regions around the capital city. The Afghan government blames neighboring Pakistan for supporting Taliban's ongoing rapid territorial gains, an allegation Pakistan denies. With new law in the bilateral ties between Afghanistan and Pakistan, influential former diplomats, think tanks, and politicians from the both sides held meeting in Islamabad. The objective behind this gathering, better known as Track 2 diplomacy, is to bring down the tension between two countries and help Kabul to find out a peaceful solution. Negotiations between the Taliban and Ashraf Ghani government have resumed in Doha with no progress in sight. The Taliban wants setting up their brand of an Islamic government while Ashraf Ghani is not willing to accept an interim setup to replace him. The U.S. fears the Taliban could possibly overrun the capital, Kabul, if President Ashraf Ghani does not strike a peace deal with them.
And the withdrawal obviously will take place, with or without the settlement. God forbid we are sucked back into the 90s. And there is anarchy, civil war. Is that a concern? Yes, it is.
The U.S. has made it clear that Pentagon would not carry out airstrikes from its aircraft carriers outside Afghanistan to prevent Taliban's possible takeover of capital, Kabul.
The Americans are tired of this war. They are fatigued, and they want to leave as soon as possible. And they don't want to invest more money, more energy, and they don't want to fight in Afghanistan any longer. Taliban are very confident they will be able to establish their upper hand in any future dispensation.
In a recent interview with a German newspaper, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said he knows his death is just one bullet away. Analysts believe that his remarks shows on how he perceives the threat of Taliban's violent takeover of capital, Kabul, after the U.S. lost war and left his government onto the mercy of warring Taliban. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The Canadian province of Ontario launches a search for unmarked graves of Indigenous residential school students. Officials announced an $8 million fund to look for such sites. Ontario Premier Doug Ford said the funding, spread over 3 years, will be used to identify, investigate, and protect residential school burial sites and cemeteries. Canada has been convulsed by the discovery of 215 pupils at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in the state of British Columbia, run by the Catholic Church, where only 50 deaths were officially recorded. Search operations have also turned up more unmarked student grave sites in Manitoba and Saskatchewan provinces. Meanwhile, the U.S. and the European Union have agreed to a long-term truce in their dispute over subsidies to plane makers Airbus and Boeing. Truce was formalized during the first summit between the U.S. President Joe Biden and European leaders Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen in Brussels. Von der Leyen hailed the meeting as a breakthrough in the long-running feud. It'll see the removal of tariffs on over $11 billion worth of goods. Tariffs were imposed on a tit-for-tat basis over state subsidies for Boeing and Airbus. However, earlier this year, Biden and von der Leyen suspended the retaliatory tariffs. Both sides have said that they are trying to clear the slate of trade disputes to consolidate a more friendly phase and jointly tackle other issues, including China and Russia. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
They came after Julian because he exposed the more than 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, because he exposed the torture and abuse of some 800 men and boys aged between 14 and 89 at Guantanamo, because he exposed that Hillary Clinton in 2009 ordered U.S. diplomats to spy on UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other UN representatives from China, France, Russia, and the UK, says Chris Hedges, journalist, in an article titled "World's Most Powerful Imprisoned Julian Assange for His Virtues, Not His Vices." Stay tuned for more. A society that prohibits the capacity to speak in truth extinguishes the capacity to live in justice. Yes, all of us know and admire Julian Assange and decry his prolonged suffering and the suffering of his family. Yes, we demand that the many wrongs and injustices that have been visited upon him be ended. We honor him up for his courage and his integrity. But the battle for Julian's liberty has always been much more than the persecution of a publisher. It is the most important battle for press freedom of our era. And if we lose this battle, it will be devastating, not only for Julian and his family, but for all people around the world. The long campaign against Julian and WikiLeaks is a window into the collapse of the rule of law. Tyrannies invert the rule of law. They turn the law into an instrument of injustice. They cloak their crimes in a faux legality. They use the decorum of the courts and trials to mask their criminality. Those such as Julian, who expose that criminality to the public, are dangerous, for without the pretext of legitimacy, the tyranny loses credibility and has nothing left in its arsenal but fear, coercion, and violence. There was no legal basis to hold Julian Assange in prison. There was no legal basis to try him, an Australian citizen under the U.S. Espionage Act. The CIA spied on Julian in the embassy through a Spanish company, UC Global, contracted to provide embassy security. This spying included recording the privileged conversations between Julian and his lawyers as they discussed his defense. This fact alone invalidated the trial. Julian is being held in a high-security prison so the state can, as Nils Melzer, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, has testified, continue the degrading abuse and torture it hopes will lead to his psychological, if not physical, disintegration. The U.S. government directed, as Craig Murray so eloquently documented, the London prosecutor James Lewis. Lewis presented these directives to Beritzer. Beritzer adopted them as her legal decision. It was judicial pantomime. Lewis and the judge insisted they were not attempting to criminalize journalists and muzzle the press while they easily set up the legal framework to criminalize journalists and muzzle the press. And that is why the court worked so hard to mask the proceedings from the public, limiting access to the courtroom to a handful of observers and making it hard and at times impossible to access the trial online. It was a tawdry show trial, not an example of the best of jurisprudence. architects of imperialism, the masters of war, the corporate-controlled legislative, judicial, and executive branches of government, and their obsequious courtiers in the media are illegitimate. Say this simple truth and you are banished, as many of Americans have been, to the margins of the media landscape. Prove this truth as Assange, Chelsea Manning, Jeremy Hammond, and Edward Snowden have by allowing Americans to peer into the inner workings of power, and they are hunted down and persecuted. Shortly after WikiLeaks released the Iraq war logs in October 2010, which documented numerous U.S. war crimes, including video images of the gunning down of two Reuters journalists and 10 other unarmed civilians in the collateral murder video, the routine torture of Iraqi prisoners, the covering up of thousands of civilian deaths and the killing of nearly 700 civilians that had approached too closely to U.S. checkpoints, the towering civil rights attorneys Len Wenglass met with Julian in a studio apartment in central London. Julian's personal bank cards had been blocked. Three encrypted laptops with documents detailing U.S. war crimes had disappeared from his luggage en route to London. Swedish police were fabricating a case against him in a move Ratner warned that was about extraditing Julian to the United States. They came after Julian Assange because he exposed the more than 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, because he exposed the torture and abuse of some 800 men and boys aged between 14 and 89 at Guantanamo, because he exposed that Hillary Clinton in 2009 ordered U.S. diplomats to spy on U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other U.N. representatives from China, France, Russia, and the U.K., spying that included obtaining DNA, iris scans, fingerprints, and personal passwords, part of the long pattern of illegal surveillance that included the eavesdropping on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan in the weeks before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Because Assange exposed that Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and the CIA orchestrated the June 2009 military coup in Honduras that overthrew the democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya, replacing it with a murderous and corrupt military regime. Because Assange exposed that George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and General David Petraeus prosecuted a war in Iraq that under post-Nuremberg laws is defined as a criminal war of aggression, a war crime, that they authorized hundreds of targeted assassinations, including those of U.S. citizens in Yemen, and that they secretly launched missile, bomb, and drone attacks in Yemen, killing scores of civilians. Because Assange exposed that Goldman Sachs paid Hillary Clinton $657,000 to give talks a sum so large it can only be considered a bribe, and that she privately assured corporate leaders she would do their bidding while promising the public financial regulation and reform. Because Assange exposed the internal campaign to discredit and destroy British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn by members of his own party. Because Assange exposed how the hacking tools used by the CIA and the National Security Agency permits the wholesale government surveillance of Americans' televisions, computers, smartphones, and antivirus software, allowing the government to record and store American people's conversations, images, and private text messages, even from encrypted apps. Yes, Julian Assange exposed the truth. He exposed it over and over and over until there was no question of the endemic illegality, corruption, and mendacity that defines the global ruling elite. And for these truths, they came after Julian Assange, as they have come after all who dared rip back the veil in power. The criminal ruling class has all locked in its death grip. It cannot be reformed. It has abolished the rule of law. It obscures and falsifies the truth. It seeks the consolidation of its obscene wealth and power.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو ذا الرحمن Allah هو ذا المنان لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum. This is your host, Haider al-Bahadli from Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. Today we have our dear esteemed guest, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, with us. Sheikhana, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Sheikhana, we have a question about the Sunni-Shia discussion. The question is as follows. Why is the adhan, the call to prayer, and the prayer of Shiites, of Shia imamis and Sunnis, different? Why is it different? Didn't our prophet pray in front of them? And didn't he pray in one way, in one method? Or did he pray in different methods?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that Shias and Sunnis, they have many things in common when it comes to Islamic beliefs and jurisprudence. So we should not think that the differences outnumber the commonalities. This is not the case. The common beliefs and the common laws between Shia and Sunnis are a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But we cannot ignore the fact that there are differences. Now, let me share one point before going to the answering the question. We can claim that the differences in beliefs are much important than differences in jurisprudence. So, for example, the succession of the Prophet, the one who was the first caliph after the Holy Prophet, is much more important than, for example, whether Hayya ala Khayr al-Amal is a part of Adhan or not. Now, according to Shia school of thought, and of course it's been mentioned in Sunni sources as well, about 70 days before the demise of the Prophet, on the 18th of Dhul Hijjah in Ghadir Khum, the Holy Prophet introduced Imam Ali alayhi salam as his successor and caliph after him. But about 70 days later, Muslims did not act upon this very explicit statement of the Prophet, and they chose Abu Bakr as the first caliph.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my point is that when we have such an important issue like caliphate, and the Muslims only 70 days after the explicit statement of the Prophet are not going to act upon it,
mm-hmm.
then when we go to jurisprudence,
You're talking about the event of Al-Ghadir.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where he appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib as caliphate.
Yeah. My
so
point
after
is
70
that
days, yeah.
We have, after 70 days, Muslims did not act upon that explicit statement of mm-hmm. the Prophet about a very important issue like caliphate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mentioned that. Is the issue of caliphate more important, or whether Hayya ala Khayr al-Amal is a part of Adhan or not? Of course, the issue of caliphate is much more important.
Exactly.
But the Muslims did not act upon the explicit statement of the Prophet. Now, Answering the question why the Adhan and the prayer of the Shia and Sunni are different, first of all, as I mentioned, there are many common things. We should not think that everything is different, but of course there are differences. Now, regarding Adhan and the prayer, we know that the Noble Book of Quran has only referred to some general laws and rulings, and the details are mentioned in the narration. Now, after the Holy Prophet, who are we going to refer to? The companions of the Prophet, who according to the Shia are fallible, except for Imam Ali alayhi salam, or the Ahlul Bayt, who according to the Shia are infallible? Are we going to refer to Ahlul Bayt or the Caliph? So this is what makes such differences when it comes to the way that, people say the Adhan or say the prayer. Let me give you some examples. So we don't, in this program, we are not going to say that the way that Shia, they say the Adhan, they call the prayer, and they say the prayer is the correct one, and we have evidences from the Sunni sources is another topic. I'm just referring to some of the reasons that we have such differences.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So when it comes to Adhan, for example, and the fact that nowadays Hayya ala Khayr al-Amal is recited by the Shia and not by Ahlul Sunnah, we can find it in Sunni sources that it was the second caliph who omitted Hayya ala Khayr al-Amal from the Adhan and Iqamah. And I mean, Ahlul Sunnah, they are not apologetic for it. They say that yes, it was practiced by the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, but it was abandoned by the second caliph. And as a great companion of the Prophet, the second caliph had all the right to do that. So, for example, it's been mentioned by one of the Hanafi scholars that the second caliph once told the people that three issues were permitted at the time of the Prophet, but I consider them as haram: the mutha, the temporary marriage, hajjut tamattu, and hajj ala khayr al amal. So, as I mentioned, the main difference is that are we going to, after the Holy Prophet, are we going to refer to the infallible imams as the Shia believe, or to the companions of the Prophet
and the caliphs?
This makes difference. According to us, the a statement of the second caliph in changing the behavior of the Prophet is baseless. According to the Sunnis, he had the right to do that. So this is one of the reasons that we have, for example, this difference when it comes to Adhan. Or adding As-salatu khayrun min an-nawm. Ahlul Sunnah, they have it in the Adhan of morning prayer, but as Shia, we follow the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, we know that it's not a part of Adhan. Again, the Sunnis, they agree that it was not a part of Adhan,
but it was implemented in the time of the second caliph.
Of the second caliph. He thought that it would be great for the people to mention that and include,
to remind them that prayer is better than sleeping.
And he omitted Hayya ala Khayr al-Amal according to some narrations, because the argument was that when we say that the best action is prayer, people will take jihad lightly. So it's better for us to omit. So for Ahlul Sunnah, who consider the companions of the Prophet as just people, as the people that they need to refer after the Holy Prophet and take their religion from, for them it's logical. But as Shia, we do not believe in this. We believe that, first of all, whatever was permitted and forbidden at the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family, will be so till the day of judgment. We cannot change the sunnah of the Prophet. Second of all, the companions of the Prophet, except for Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, all of them were fallible human beings, and we only take our religions from our infallible imams.
So, alayhi salam. So in relation to prayer and adhan, there is some changes that you mentioned in regarding to prayer, that to adhan, sorry, that there's some change done in the time of the second caliph to the adhan. That's why the adhan is now different. Mm-hmm. The Shia still has the same adhan as the time of a prophet.
Yeah.
But in regard to the prayer, what happened there? Was there also something added after the death of the prophet that Shia do not accept? Or what happened there?
There are two issues that I would like to mention here. First of all, again, some of the differences in prayer are related to the time after the demise of the prophet.
Mm.
For example, one of the differences between Shia and Sunni schools of thought regarding the prayer is about the concept that we call it takattuf.
Mm.
The fact that our Sunni brothers and sisters, they put one hand...
Place their arms over the other.
Yeah, over the other, mm-hmm. when they, say Surah Al-Fatiha and another chapter of the Quran. But as Shia, we believe that it's not permitted at all. So it's been mentioned even in Sunni sources that, again, at least according to some reports, it was added to prayer by the second caliph. It seems that he saw that this is done by some people in front of their kings, and he asked about the reason. They said that it's a matter of respect. It shows it's showing that we are respecting the king, for example. The second caliph thought that it would be also great to add it in the prayer as well. So this is one of the differences between Shia and Sunnis with regards to prayer. Another point that is one of the reasons why we have all these differences between Shias and Sunnis is the fact that after the demise of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, writing down the narrations of the Prophet was officially banned by the second caliph. According to some scholars, it was forbidden at the time of the first caliph as well. So imagine, as I mentioned, in the Quran we have only some general points about prayer, about wudu, ablution, and so on and so forth. The details are not mentioned by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran. So for the details, we are in need of the narrations. Now imagine for some decades, for about one century, Muslims are forbidden from writing down the narrations of the Prophet. So the next generation after the Prophet, like 40, 50 years after the Prophet, they only have the Quran. They have no narration written down which tell them about the way that they need to say the prayer or make wudu or say the adhan. Because for one century, writing down the narrations of the Prophet was forbidden.
Mm.
So there is no access to the prophetic narrations. What is the solution? They are forced to refer to companions and to the Tabi'un. And we know that there are so many companions of the Prophet, so many Tabi'un, and for sure, in many cases, they had differences of ideas about the way that the Holy Prophet used to say the prayer. The problem is that the prophetic narrations were not preserved for like one century. This caused, many of such differences that nowadays we have. As Shia, we believe that because of the fact that after the demise of the Prophet till today, till the Day of Judgment, always we have an infallible imam alive, a present hujja, a divine proof. So for any period during the history of Islam, especially before the minor occultation, Shia had access to an alive imam. So even if the writing down the narration is forbidden for Muslims, it's not a big problem for the Shia.
Exactly.
Because at any time they have access to the present imam, they can ask their questions. And we believe that the answers of the imams are, I mean, like the answers of the prophet, free from any kind of mistake. Mm-hmm. And this is not the case for the companions and Tabi'un. So one of the other reasons that we have such differences between Shia and Sunni is the fact that writing down the narrations was banned by the second caliph.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada. It was a pleasure to have you here. This is your host, Haider Mbahadli, from Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum.
لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى محن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. The Justice Department will tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides. Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and staff. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Charlie Savage. The piece is titled, Justice Department Will Toughen Rules for Seizing Lawmakers' Data, Garland says. Justice Department may tighten its rules for when law enforcement officials may seize information about members of Congress and their aides. Attorney General Merrick Garland said on Monday, 14th of June, amid a backlash to the disclosure of a 2018 subpoena that swept in data from the Apple accounts of Democratic lawmakers and their staff. Later in the day, Merrick Garland also met with leaders of the New York Times, CNN, and the Washington Post, after the disclosure of the Trump Justice Department had secretly seized phone records of reporters at each outlet in search of their sources. President Joe Biden and Attorney General Merrick Garland have said that prosecutors will no longer be permitted to use that tactic. The two events underscored how recent revelations displaying the power of prosecutors to secretly seize records from phone and technology companies for leak investigations have become a major political headache for the Biden-era Justice Department, even as many questions remain about the context. David McGraw, a New York Times newsroom lawyer who attended the meeting with his publisher, A.G. Sulzberger, portrayed the discussion about restricting the ability of leak hunters to go after reporters' data as positive. Under an agreement, news executives were permitted to disclose what they said, but Attorney General Merrick Garland's responses were off the record. In today's meeting, we once again sought a full accounting of what happened and requested that the Department of Justice codify that it will no longer seize journalists' records during leak investigations, Mr. Sulzberger said in a statement. We were encouraged by Attorney General Merrick Garland's statements, but we will continue to push until our concerns are addressed. The meeting came hours after Attorney General Merrick Garland had addressed the political uproar over the subpoena for congressional information, which the New York Times reported last week. He said he had asked his deputy, Lisa O'Monico, to review and toughen the department's existing policies for obtaining records of the legislative branch, noting that she was already working on surfacing potentially problematic matters deserving high-level review. Mr. Garland added, consistent with our commitment to the rule of law, we must ensure that full weight is accorded to separation of powers concerns moving forward. That announcement came as John C. Demers, the Trump administration official who leads the Justice Department's National Security Division, which oversees leak investigations, told his staff that he would step down at the end of next week. On Sunday, Democratic lawmakers had called for John C. Demers to testify about the subpoena that swept in congressional information, along with the former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and the former Attorney Generals Jeff Sessions and William Barr. But on Monday, 14th of June, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader in the Senate, denounced those calls, saying that an investigation by the Justice Department's independent inspector general was sufficient. By calling for a congressional inquiry, he said, top Democrats gave in to the urge to pick at the scab of politically motivated investigations. The Department of Justice is empowered to investigate criminal conduct by members of Congress and their staff. Necessarily, this sort of investigation is subject to strict procedural protections, Mitch McConnell said. The department's inspector general is fully equipped to determine whether these procedures were followed. I'm confident that the existing inquiry will uncover the truth. He also said that it was particularly disappointing that our colleagues are attacking Bill Barr over investigative decisions that occurred when he wasn't there yet. The grand jury subpoena that swept up congressional information was dated February 2018, when Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein were still the top two officials in the Justice Department. Still, after William Barr was sworn in the following year, the New York Times has reported, he brought in a trusted prosecutor with little relevant experience to help reinvigorate several leaked cases, including that involved congressional Democrats and their staff. Eventually, it was shut down without charges. Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois, the number two Democrat who has supported calling for former Attorney General to testify, pushed back at Mitch McConnell's suggestion that there was nothing amiss, asking, how would he know that? Senator Richard Durbin, who is also the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, sent a letter signed by the other 10 Democrats on that panel to Merrick Garland on Monday, asking for a copy of the subpoena and internal emails and other records related to it, and posing questions about its basis and purpose. The subpoena appears to have been part of a leak investigation that centered on a Democratic aide on the House Intelligence Committee. The New York Times has previously reported that it listed 109 phone numbers and email addresses and sought account data linked to those numbers. Two lawmakers, Representatives Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, both Democrats of California, were among those whose account information Apple turned over, along with aides and a relative of Adam Schiff's. The broad subpoena appears to have been an example of a common technique investigators use when they obtain the communications records of a target. By subpoenaing electronic communication providers for any account information linked to those phone numbers or email addresses, they can identify the people with whom the target interacted. For example, many people own a smartphone that uses either Apple or Google's operating systems and register their phone numbers with one of those companies when setting up their devices. Those accounts may also have their names, addresses, email addresses, data about the phone and computer hardware they use to access the account, and sometimes even credit card numbers. While the controversies over secret Trump-era seizures of data about reporters and about lawmakers and their staff have partly emerged, there is an important difference. The phone data seized about reporters at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN centered on a type of metadata, calling logs, that reveals whom people have spoken with. The Justice Department also carried out a related legal fight over a court order it obtained for logs of the reporters' emails, which can also reveal social contacts that spilled into the Biden era and included gag orders imposed on executives at the New York Times and CNN. By contrast, there is no sign that the subpoena to Apple could have provided investigators with a type of metadata that would offer a systematic look at the lawmakers' contacts with other people. According to law enforcement officials, prosecutors cannot use a grand jury subpoena to obtain email logs. Instead, they obtain court orders if they want to seize the information logging senders and recipients of emails and other types of electronic messages. Apple, which is not a phone company and does not generate traditional calling logs, has said it turned over only account subscriber information in response to the grand jury and that it did not provide any content such as emails or pictures.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.